Welcome to the Swedish Innovation Podcast, where we export Swedish unicorness.
No buzzwords, just real life stories with Sweden's most innovative thinkers and doers. A podcast made by me, Sandra Bourbon.
And me, Sara Hermansson.
Today, me, Sandra Bourbon, will talk to Maximilian Tropé. He's a mental trainer, author, and speaker, and he knows what you need to know when it comes to setting a goal to succeed with your innovation work. He calls it an extraordinary result. That's the goal you set to get extraordinary result when it comes to your innovation work. Maximilian will tell us how a drug company used this method to go from one new drug per year to instead two, to double the output. He will explain the model and how you can use it and also how to get started. Let's talk to Maximilian Tropé. Welcome to the Swedish Innovation Podcast, Maximilian Tropé.
Hi, and thanks for having me at your podcast.
You're a mental trainer, author, speaker. You've done a lot. You have a background as an elite sports with ice hockey. And you are here today because you are an expert on how to set really smart goals when it comes to innovation to succeed with your innovation work. So that will be super interesting to hear more about. But let's start off, like, how did it all start? Your background, when did you start to be interested in this kind of goal setting and innovation?
For me, it started already when I was playing hockey. I was constantly interested and curious around how to move my own barriers. And I don't know if it was because my own experience of having a lot of barriers. And I noticed that when I was playing, most of them were what I would today define as mental and not my physical capabilities. So that interested me from the beginning, and even more when I moved from being a player to being a coach, and then when I moved into the field of economics and psychology, that was my area of focus. It's always been like almost like an obsession with human potential.
Okay, so what do you do today to help companies and people?
Today I have three legs in my business. One is that I today support and facilitate other elite sport athletes within a lot of different both the teams and individuals going to the Olympics, etc. The other leg of the business is doing the same, but mostly for executives, creating support structure and helping them break their self-imposed boundaries to really be able to explore what their full capacity is. And the third one is to work with system transformation, and that is with the model based on the book that we're going to talk about later, For Full Potential, working with how can we realize the unrealized potential within our organization. First of all, how can we identify them? And secondly, of how do we go about realizing them?
Great. I know we talked a little before this episode, and I know in former episodes, when we talk about innovation with a lot of other people, CEOs, and who it can be, usually it's easy for companies to see when you're really threatened. Now we need to really up our game when it comes to innovation. But in the perfect world, you would like to pursue innovation before you're threatened, right? When you see this opportunity. But then it's always tricky to get people to change, right? And focus from maybe a business that works well. And in order, like, how do we do this? Because you talk about the mental and the psychological barrier when it comes to innovation.
Exactly. It's like rewiring the way our brain operates, because the same as your other CEOs that you've been talking to before noticed that you know, the big changes are happening when they're threatening or when they have to. And that's how the brain is wired from the beginning. It's wired to survive, and it's wired to save on energy. It doesn't like to consume too much energy. And both of those, when you look to an innovative process, is of course taking risks, choosing to venture out into the unknown. It is to put in a lot of energy into something that is rather uncertain. So it is about, so if we're going to start such a process when we don't have to, we then have to find a passion. We have to find a why within ourselves. It is not imposed to us by the surrounding environment. It's rather something that starts within us. And that could take room in a lot of different circumstances. Sometimes it is about allowing oneself to become aware of the cost of just doing the necessary, of just waiting or letting the reality itself dictate the pace of change or innovation. You know, what cost does it have in me personally? What cost does it have in other people around me? And thirdly, what cost does it have on the organization or the company that I belong to? Because most people walk around and they of course have a payoff for operating this way, that they don't have to encounter situations that they're not comfortable with handling. Because that's the one common fear that we all have together, that we do not like to encounter a situation where we don't feel capable of handling the situation itself. So we have different behavior patterns and mental patterns to avoid those situations. So here I have to more consciously decide to go against those basic drivers within myself. And for me, that is about finding something that I'm really passionate about. I think that if you look to organizations or individuals, etc., that is constantly driving innovation or is constantly exploring what is really possible, they're driven by something from the inside. It's an urge, it's a will to constantly be curious about what is the next step, what's beyond this.
Would you say it's different if you're focusing on more on disruptive innovation or the sustaining incremental innovation? I guess that disruptive innovation, that's even more unknown, so you have even higher mental or psychological barriers.
Exactly, and I think that you would both have higher psychological and mental barriers, but you will also have the barriers of the system itself, because the more disruptive, the more threatened the current system will be, and the more you will be opposed. If you see people that are successful in a lot of the disruptive changes, it's not like they have been supported by the surrounding system immediately. A lot of time you are met with a lot of skepticism or outright behaviors that is trying to block you. So I think that the more we disrupt, the more inertia and blockages, both on the individual psychology level, but also on the system level, we encounter.
What do you think is the most important, like what do you need to do to succeed with getting rid of these barriers?
You have to take a stand. It's like with most things, and that process could sometimes take a minute, that could sometimes take a week, that could sometimes take a year. But when you come to that moment when you really decide, you do understand what you need to do differently. You do understand what you need to let go of, and you do understand all of these uncertainty, but you still choose to do it. It is that moment when you really fully take a stand. There is no going back. We embark on this road.
Is that like the CEO, or who will take this stand?
That could be different people within an organization. I think if you look to an organizational disruption or change of operating pattern within an organization, it will not happen in the entire system if you don't have the CEO as one of the driving forces within it. But you do see in a lot of organizations that you have parts of it being really innovative, being really disruptive, where other parts are remaining more traditional. So I think it could be both on individual level, group level, and all the way, of course, up to CEO level.
Mm. And you have written together with a co-author a book about how to set super smart goals to help you in this process, I guess. Can you explain more? Like, what's the model? How do you set the goals? Why does it work?
Yeah, I'm just going to super short background. We come from two different worlds. Jan Carlson, that is my co-author, from the field of engineering, economics, and a researcher from the University of Linköping. I come from the field of behavioral science and psychology, but we were both sitting on different sides of the university looking at the same problem. Why is it so hard to implement really strong new knowledge within the organizations? So that was the reason why we met. You know, we could see that inertia, and we were so amazed at things that were proven and over again on research level could sometimes take 15, 20 years before it was implemented for real in a lot of organizations. So that was our standpoint. From that standpoint, we got an assignment to look at how could you really realize and manifest sustainable change in an entire system over time from a large group of corporations in Scandinavia. And what we looked at from a scientific point of view was those people that were delivering extraordinary results over time, what separated them from people who weren't, or parts of the business who did and parts of the business who didn't? And what we could see was that those who were really delivering these extraordinary results over time, they were both acting in new ways and letting go of the old. So then we were thinking about how can we go from this just being a happening by chance to more get a structured process to really make sure that this is happening. And that's where we came up with the concept of extraordinary goals or extraordinary results, as we call it. And that is a result that we generate from asking ourselves, why do we exist? What is it that gives us a reason to exist? It could be within the parts of a business or the entire organization. And then we look into, from that why, what is it that we are supposed to deliver? And then we go down to, okay, so how does those deliverables look today? And then the fourth one is that, okay, so what could an extraordinary result be? And that means that we're putting up a result or a target that we don't have any clue at all of how to reach. The only thing that we know is that we can't keep on doing more of the same. And we need to do both act in a new way and letting go of the old. So it implies an innovative process in itself. And
would you say it's harder for people? Like, what's hardest, to do new things or letting go of old things?
Letting go.
Yeah.
We call it in the book the marshmallow effect. You see this in a lot of organization. They go into new field, they focus on that field or a certain KPI, and when they focus and they work with it, they're starting to see results. But as soon as they stop focusing on that KPI or that part of the business and they shift focus to something else, slowly but surely that part of the business or that KPI go back to the old result. We call that the marshmallow effect. It looks like if you push a marshmallow together, it looks like we have changed the shape of it.
Yeah.
But if you put it on the table, it goes back. And this is the part where we need to act in new ways to create a motion into the future. But to make that motion or result sustainable, we need to let go of the old. Otherwise, the old will start surely and slowly to pull back the new back to where we started.
How do you let go of the old things?
First of all, it's about identifying what are the payoffs for not changing, or as we call it, the payoffs for being, now try to figure out the word in English, the word for bequem.
Comfortable.
Yeah, comfortable. So we all have payoffs of being comfortable or staying within our comfort zone. And those are often that we do not have to encounter, because when we're going to do certain things, it implies that we also need to be beginners in the start. So we need to encounter the feeling of being incompetent.
Yeah, that's hard for grown-ups, I think.
Exactly. And yeah, especially if you look to yourself and others that are in the field of competence, how much do we like to be incompetent?
No.
How much do we like not to understand?
No, that we don't like at all.
So what is normal, as you say, that you see in most kids, and that's an interesting also if you look to science where I come from, that most kids seems to have this natural from the beginning, to be curious about reality, to be curious about how you can do certain things, and they're rather free in their exploration because they're not so focused on the fears of failure or the fears of being incompetent. They're more focused on what and how they can develop and what and how they can learn. But as we grow older, the fear concept becomes stronger and stronger within ourselves.
Yeah. Why?
Because it takes energy to change. And if you look to the human brain, either you want to or not, your brain will develop to a certain age of 25 or 28. We have different development stages. You go through different experiences in your life to becoming an adult. After that, around 28 or maybe 30, then to have a change or develop, that's a part of a conscious choice or a change in your surrounding environment that forces you to change.
Yeah.
So it consumes more energy and it's not a part of our just natural being. But as we're growing up, it is part of that natural process of going from being a kid to being an adult.
I'm thinking of corporate culture. I think like 80% of our corporate cultures are like, you can name them expert cultures. So you get promoted like when you know a lot of things, basically. So that actually, it's counterproductive. When it comes to innovation and to be curious to learn new things. But how do you make sure with the culture to align it with this when you set your extraordinary result?
So the first thing that we do, of course, then setting this extraordinary result, and here it's extremely important that the result or the target is set at the core of what we do. A lot of time we try to drive innovative processes that are a little nice to have when things are going well. But when we need to prioritize and or when we face the difficult time, that's not where we're putting our focus and our resources. So it needs to be at the core business. And we need to understand that when we put the UR right, we need to understand when we take a stand, what does it imply for us? What do we need to, in what way do we need to act new? And then what do we really have to let go of to reach this extraordinary result? And when we see that, we can, in a grown-up way, decide, do we really want to do this? That's the first one we take a stand. Later on, we will see if that taking a stand was for real or not by the actions needed to realize the goal. But what you're talking about, how can we align culture with the goal, and that's our second model that we borrowed from a guy called Ken Wilber, that we modified it to really work in an innovative change process. And it is a simple four-quadrant model that involves four specific areas, that those four specific areas their interaction between each other could explain any type of result that we see within an organization, but also explain why we don't see certain things. And we can also see where do we have our hidden gold, or as we say, where do you have those unrealized potentials that could take your company or organization to the next level. So we have what we call the production apparatus, that there you have your processes, your structures, your role and interplay, you have what you measure and don't measure, and you have what you do, you know, how do we work with innovation or change in this company? And then you have capabilities or competence. What are the core competences we have or capabilities that we have within the system? And then the third one is internal drivers and motivators. What is it that really motivate people? You know, what is it that they want to accomplish? What do they want to do and what do they not want to do? And then you have culture. And culture is, of course, what is the common we? Do we have a common we? And if we look to innovation, sometimes we try to do things, especially if we do it more disruptively, that goes against the culture that we have today. And here I think it's extremely important for companies to understand that when you do those changes, and those changes often happens in the area that we call the production apparatus, that if you don't work with a culture at the same time, you will have a culture that is constantly blocking the results or the motion that you want to create by the change in the production apparatus.
Yeah, but is it really possible? We talked to Kurt Matzler, that is the co-author of the book Open Strategy, and he said basically what you need to do if it's a disruptive innovation, it will go, as you say, against your whole system, the whole business model, everything, like what your current business stands for, basically. So to succeed in most cases, you need to create like a separate company or something to like break it out from the current system. Do you agree with that, or can you solve it in another way?
I would agree with that. I'm not sure that you necessarily would have to build a new separate company next to it, but you come to a certain situation sometimes when the current system is so out of sync with the reality it's supposed to work in, or what you really want to accomplish, that you can't just make these, you can't just polish the old system or tweak it or making small changes within it. You just have to reinvent the entire system. And that, of course, is extremely difficult to do within the old system. So I would say that yes, in my experience, it is difficult to invent a totally new system and put it into place within the old structure.
If we would get down to really, really detail, like how do you do this for real? Can you take an example and like guide us through the process? Like, do you have a meeting with the management? You set the goal. What do you do in this process? Like, if.
Often the customer or company approach us because they've been stuck in a certain innovative process, or they want to realize something that they know is there, but they haven't really been able to do it themselves. So what we do is that we first have a strategic meeting together with them to understand the context and what they're really trying to do. So I can take an example.
How many are you in this meeting, and what kind of people is it?
If I take it in this example, it was within a drug company in Switzerland. Then we had the management team of the R&D. They knew from the business context that they needed to move from generating one new product onto the market each year to three, which is an enormous, gigantic change in delivery. Within such a type of business. So we would then sit together with the management team. And in that case, they already had themselves an extraordinary target defined within the group. Their problem was that they couldn't really understand how they would make this happen or realize this goal. So we would then have a meeting and we would look, okay, so from where we are today, what needs to change? You know, in what ways do we need to act new, and what do we need to let go of? And are you really willing to do those things needed to really have a chance to succeed in realizing this goal? And that is a process that's often going back and forth over 2-3 meetings, because the logic of in itself is very seldom the big problem. It is really to make sure that there is a full ownership within the management system that is going to realize this change.
But because it easy to map, like, this is what we're doing now, this is what we need to let go of? That's kind of easy to just get this down on paper somehow.
Yes. And then we do it even more specific, that we use, you know, this 4-quadrant model that I talked about. Then we do an analysis of, okay, so if we want to go from 1 drug a year to 3 drugs a year, that is our extraordinary result. Then we stand in that extraordinary result and we look at today's system. And then we look at today's production apparatus. What is right and what is wrong with today's production apparatus in relationship to the new goal? Then we go into the next quadrant and we look at, so what capabilities and what competences do we have and which don't we have in relationship to the new extraordinary result? Then we go into the quadrant of individual motivators or drivers, and we're looking, okay, so in relationship to the new EOR, what do people want to do and what don't they want to do? And then finally, we go into the quadrant of culture. So standing in the new EOR, in relationship to that EOR, what is okay and what is not okay in today's culture? So then we get a really good view of how reality looks like in relationship to the new result. And here the difficulty or the challenge is to help the organization see those part of reality that they don't really accept and that they can't really cope with today. That's the challenge that is up to us as consultants to help them with. When reality is identified and analyzed, then we move over and we create a very specific 4-quadrant model. How does the system look like that is delivering the extraordinary result? How does that production apparatus look like? How does those competences look like? What are the motivators or drivers that are being able to be pursued in that system? And how does a culture look like that is supporting the system that is generating EOR? And when you have, and often the problem when you are trying to create that future state is three. One is that most management team have a very hard difficulty of letting go of the limitations of today's reality.
How do you help them with that? How do you help them to
move? Over and over again, because they would bring up, we don't have these resources today, or we organize there. So you will constantly have to help them in the dialogue. But yes, this is today's reality, but we're parking it. It's like bringing them back to this blank sheet of paper over and over again. And it is difficult because people tend to cling. They do not really want to see the new reality before they have, like, solved all the problem in today's reality. But we can't really be innovative if we don't allow ourselves to dream free or to really look to what is possible if we take away the limitations of today. But it is a back and forth game all the time, and reminding them that you're now bringing in to the equations limitations that are not relevant for this part of the process. So that's one of them.
Yeah.
The second one, when you have management teams, is often what happens is they see the new logical setup and way of operating might not be a way of operating that I like. Or it could be that we have 3 business areas today, but the logic says we should only have 2. So the ability to actually decide, on a relevant and logical future that is realizing the EOR when that might go against my personal interests.
Yeah.
And that's a huge one. I've seen it so many times that people at the top will be an inertia and a blockage for the system to develop because they're protecting their own self-interests.
How do you overcome that?
What we do there is that we help them highlight and identify the cost of their own behaviors.
So basically what they're missing out of if they don't...
If you have I know you have read the book, but there is this passage in the book when we running this simulation that we have that make it very obvious for the company that if we would organize us in a way that would realize the full potential, then these would be the consequences. And in this organization, the CIO or CFO starts to understand what this really means. And he gets so uncomfortable with reality. So it's a simulation built in Lego. So he starts to hiding the Lego pieces because okay. He understands that they are willing to pay for their own comfort zone. In those days, this is a case that is a little over 10 years, 10.5 billion Swedish crowns a year. It becomes so obvious for him. And he did not want to have that discussion.
That's also, I guess, down to psychology, mental barriers again. Start to hide the Lego pieces. Okay.
Because reality, you know, he starts to understand, yes, we have the opportunity and we somehow know where we need to go to realize the full potential of the system. But to go there, that's where what do you need to let go of inside? We need to address issues that are extremely uncomfortable. It might be extremely uncomfortable for certain very strong individuals within our own management team.
Since you come in as an external part, it feels like you almost need that, like new eyes, somebody from outside that's not biased or like need to think of all political or like who decides what and stuff like that. Would you say that's also a strength?
I would say that is a necessity. And I would say that there are two parts of the necessity that we have found when we work with our model is that you need someone that could mirror what is happening from the inside. This is the world of psychology, what is happening within certain individuals, but also within the culture. But you also need to match that with an external view of someone who really understands the business itself. That's what we call an outside facilitator, an inside facilitator. Because when we work in that way, we create this container, because a lot of these discussions will be like mini explosions. But to build in a container that can hold those explosions without making them creating a situation that is sub-optimizing the process, it needs to hold that friction. Between, because the blockages could both be on the outside, which I meet a lot of time when we look at the new changes that the new digital world put, that you see a management team that is set to drive this innovative process that does not understand the new digital world. So they do really have a competence issue, but it takes a lot of psychological security to admit that we do not really have the competence to address this issue fully.
But let's go back to the drug company. They were supposed to go from one new drugs per year to three. They have now mapped like what they need to do new and what they need to get rid of. What did they do after that?
So what they saw, what was the biggest game changer where they lost time was the intersection between different areas of speciality. Because when you drive drugs in the normal process through ground research and into phase one studies, then into phase two studies, then into phase three studies, the drug companies are organized in these silos. And the cross-functional processes are not working very well. and the whole system is also built up around manifesting these conflicts of interest in between these different silos, because they're measured on different things, they're rewarded on different things. So what was obvious was, okay, we need to take a system that works very fine within each silo, but has a very ineffective interaction between the different silos to work so seamlessly.
Can a problem be like, okay, I work in like phase one, I need to get the drug to pass this first phase of trials, and then I do everything to make sure it does, but maybe I do some stuff that decreases the chance that it will pass two and three. Is that the like?
Yeah, that could be. But also within each phase, there are so many areas of speciality that are involved, and they have a little different interest, because you have those that are working on the research of the drug or the molecule itself, and then you have those that are mostly looking into making sure that this is safe and have no side effects. Then you have those that need to figure out, how do we get the patients for our phase two studies, and then you have those that have to look into the results of the phase one study to transform those results into the phase two, and they work on a little different time schemes and different logic. And if each one is just looking into their own interest, they're sub-optimizing for each other within the same phase.
Okay.
So that means that the phase takes longer than it have to. So if the whole process could be done in 3 years, it takes 6 years.
Okay.
And if you're going to then come with 3 new drugs to the market instead of one, you need to be able to run more processes at the same time. And if you then have a sub-optimized collaboration between the different areas of specialty, that also drives more resources. Not only that you get time delays, it drives more resources than needed, which means that you can't afford to drive as many different processes that you would need to guarantee 3 new products to the market.
Okay, so the silos, they needed to get rid of these.
Yes.
Was it something else they needed to do?
That was a little later on in the project, when you move over from having run the phases and you have got through all the, and being accepted by the FDA in the United States and the equivalent in Europe, etc., to put them into manufacturing, because it's not just a development. And it was very obvious that they didn't really know very much about production. And that was one of the major conflicts or the major challenges that we had to help them understand that this was the case. But you could see it in the top management team that this was a company very famous for developing and very famous for having a good sales and marketing organization. But they didn't even have one representative from the whole production system in the senior management team.
And they did the production themselves. They didn't have a third-party company.
Okay. No third-party. They did it themselves. So you could see that the way it was set up, the way it was handled, the power distribution between different areas, that production was not really something that they were very good at, because they made so much money anyway, because in the drugs industry in the beginning, the margins are so huge. So they haven't really, if you now look what we talked to before, reality hadn't dictated or demanded of them to be very good at running an efficient production. But if we're now going to have 3 new products to the market each year instead of one, means also that we have to have a totally new speed of setup within the factories, which means that also production becomes very high or important topic compared to before. So it was collaboration between the different parts in the development process, but also to really start gaining how you could work more agile and efficient within setting up new production.
Okay, so now they knew what they needed to do, kind of. What did they do after that?
So now we were running collaborative workshops. So we brought in all of these different specialties within these different phases within these different drugs that they were trying to develop. So we ran these two times 3 days really deep collaborative models where we went through the different interests, how they could work through them in a way that was building trust instead of building distrust. And how they can make sure that they became, that they built upon their ability to solve this, because the issues would be there. They don't disappear. It's more about how can we handle them in a more efficient way and at the same time building trust. And there we have a special training program that is targeting that type of issue. So we ran that with all the different teams, cross-section teams together. So you build strong bonds of strong relationship, but also a totally new different level of trust, which meant that they were starting to become their increase their level of openness in the discussion. It's one of the prerequisites for being able to solve any problem in an efficient way. And the other one was that they were starting to take responsibility not only for their own area of interest, but also for the totality. Because they were start to feel like one team. Even though they still belonged in the silo, they had one common cross-functional process that they owned together.
And I guess one common goal. Or exactly. Did they have that already? Like, why do we exist? And you had a buy-in for this. We need to go for 1 to 3 new drugs per year.
Exactly, but then you have to have a extraordinary result in each of these cross-functional team. Because if you're going to go from 1 to 3, that means that those who run phase 3 or phase 1 maybe have to go from, we normally run a phase 1 in, say, 6 years. Then, of course, there is certain scientific laws in how fast you can drive it, but you could at least be so fast so you don't lose time in relationship to what the different food and drug administrations demand of you. And that could be that they were able to take those down from 6 years to 4 years. So they would have a target that demanded how fast and efficient can we work with it and still maintain the legal requirement of us and the scientific requirements.
Okay, so then you created this great like collaborative environment, and they had the extraordinary results broken down per like group or what to say. And then I guess then when they came back for this workshop, then they needed to work. How long did it take? How many years?
We were a part of them during 3 years. It was a gigantic piece of work, because even when they start, there are long lead times. It's not like you see the end result, but what you could measure is that if you want to realize an extraordinary result within 3 years, the way we build it is also backwards planning. Then you know where you need to be within a month's time. Because if we're not at that stage within a month, then we either have to put in more resources will already forget the timeline. Or the third.
How did you keep like the momentum and the motivation during these 3 years?
We meet with them systematically once a month within all the different teams over this period. And what we are, that the model we have helped the organization generate motion. Then we are also supplying them the models and the thinking of how they can monitor if that motion is if there is motion or if there is blockage in inertia. And the thirdly that we supply them with it when they do hit blockages, and those blockages could either be on the inside human side, but they could also be on the outside business side, then we supply them with tools and processes that help them work through those blockages instead of trying to bypass them. Because if you want to innovate the system, you need to work through them. Because what happens in a lot of different situations is that the organizations themselves are bypassing. And then it looks like we have motion, but we find ourselves back at square one again.
That's when you're hiding the Lego pieces.
Exactly. Very, very good. I would use that one myself as a metaphor. But that's a very good one. Hide the Lego pieces, then we don't have to look at reality.
So did they manage to go from 1 to 3 new drugs per year?
They managed to go from 1 to 2 when we were a part of it. We couldn't, when we left the system, I can't guarantee to 100% that they had created a system that would be sustainable enough for generating that third step, because I haven't seen it or had access to it. But still, going from 1 to 2 in the world of drugs is still a very extraordinary result. So that's also a thing with extraordinary result. We can't really know if we're going to reach it or we're going to go far beyond it. Because it is a kind of a goal where we send out a test balloon somewhere. And the goal is more to force ourselves to do things in a new way. So it's not a stretched goal. It's not a smart goal in that sense, or all these other types that you can work. It's a goal that forces us to venture out in an innovative journey, because we can't reach it without having a new mindset and a new way that is working towards constantly exploring what is possible.
That is great. A last question before we end this episode is your best tips when it comes to, let's say I'm an organization, I know I need to start to innovate, although I don't see a threat right now, I see a great possibility. How do I set this goal, extraordinary result goal, to start moving forward?
I would use those four simple steps that I have begun. I would start, because there was a discussion very few companies, why do we really exist? Now, what's our reason for existing? So you get into the core of it. And coming down to it once again, what is it that we are supposed to deliver or give to the world? And then start to exploring, have we realized, are we doing this to the best ability of our best ability? Because in most organizations, I find that most people working with something are actually motivated by doing what they do in an efficient way. They haven't chosen that field of business or whatever if they do not have an interest around it. But it is about tapping into that passion. Going away, we have to do this because we have to be 5% more efficient. It is about being curious about what is really driving people at our place. Why are they waking up? Why are they coming to the office? Or why are they coming to the factory? Because if you can identify the passion with them and you connect that to the innovative process, then you will have a joy-driven process instead of a fear-driven process.
Great. Thank you so much, Maximilian Troppé, for joining Swedish Innovation. If people can find you, I guess they can reach out to you on LinkedIn. There they also have a link to your webpage. Can they buy your book on your webpage?
The easiest way is to either go into one of these book sites that exists, and exists both in Swedish and in English, or they, if they have difficulty finding it that way, they could just give me a PM on LinkedIn, and I will help them find the book.
That's great. And I will put the link to your book on one of, maybe on Amazon or on some of the more common pages. But thank you so much for joining Swedish Innovation, and have a great day.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you like what we're doing, remember to subscribe. And if you really like our podcast, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. Remember, innovation is what makes the impossible possible, and it will all start with you.